so let's see what we can get through. We're still in the topic of peace among Jews, peace between Jew and Jew, which was last week's topic. We had framed it in terms of the question of the breakaway synagogue and whether it's a good thing for a community to develop multiple synagogues because there is a lack of harmony within the group. At what point we say that that's an appropriate thing to do? Is that better? Is that worse? And so we started to address it by asking why it is that peace among Jews is considered critical within Jewish law. Why we view it as critical. And we talked about it not only as a pragmatic value, where we said you want people to be able to pool their resources, you want to avoid rifts, strengthen numbers, that sort of thing. But also, it's important as a religious value. We said that the Jewish people are not defined as, we're not identified as the Jewish people. God is not identified as our God, unless we are together in a group. And you saw that on the sheet in source 3, source 4, 5, and so on. And so what we're up to is the applications of peace as a religious value. How it is that valuing peace frames certain applications of halacha, of Jewish law. And we saw last week one principle that was in sources 7 and 8, that the principle of what I call national self-mutilation, the idea that just like we're not supposed to cut our skin, so too we're not supposed to cut ourselves up into pieces and to create communities in which different Jews practice different customs. And I noted at the time, that's not always so practical today because Jews moved from various countries into one community and whose custom is going to win? It's a very real and difficult question. But nonetheless, the goal is that Jews in one place should be engaged in the same religious practice. And that was the first application. The second application of it was Maimonides' point in source number 9 when he talked about the Poresh Min HaTzibur, the person who separates from the community. And he criticizes harshly someone who says, I'm going to do all the mitzvot. I'm not going to do anything that's wrong. I won't violate any of the commandments. But I'm going to do it myself, away from everybody else. And Maimonides says, great, this person is not allowed into Olam Haba. This person is not allowed into the next world. Flipping the page now, one last application of this requires a bit of explanation. Maimonides writes that if I am a guest in somebody else's home, in another Jew's home, I should be able to trust the kashrut. In other words, if I go into somebody else's home and I know that they're Jewish and I don't know anything negative about their style of observance, I should be able to assume that whatever they bring me, bread, meat, cheese, wine, whatever it is, assume that it's kosher. So he writes. However, there are reasons why people would not feel that they are able to trust. One reason would be because, unlike the world of Maimonides, we live in a much more sophisticated food production environment. Making bread is no longer even a simple endeavor, right? In his day, you made bread. You took wheat, you ground up the wheat, you made flour, you mix the flour with water, you bake it, and that's it. Maybe let it rise somewhere in there, otherwise it's matzah. But you make bread. Today, food production is more complex. And that's one reason things are different. Another reason things are different is because there's a greater spread of ignorance than what Maimonides saw in his community, in which people who mean very well don't necessarily know better about products. I'll give you an example. This is one of my favorite examples on it. Anyone here ever hear of the grapple? Not like wrestling. A food product called the grapple?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, what is it?
It's a cross between an apple and a grape.
So that's what people think, that it's a cross between an apple and a grape. But it is not a cross between an apple and a grape. Correct. What is it, in fact?
It must be an apple infused with grain.
Yeah, no, it's not Snapple, that's different. It's an apple soaked in grape juice. And when it first came out, it was in the produce sections, and people were buying it because they thought, well, if it's in the produce section, it must be kosher. What could go wrong with it? But if it's non-kosher grape juice, which we're going to talk about a little bit later when we talk about Jews and non-Jews, if it's non-kosher grape juice, which it was, then the grapple is not kosher. So people didn't know any better. I haven't seen them around. I don't know if they're still a thing. But the point is, lack of awareness can cause people to make mistakes. And there's also the fact that we live in a world which is much more complicated in terms of people's approach to things like keeping kosher. For some people, this standard is good enough. For some people, that standard is good enough. And so we're no longer able to trust in the same way that Maimonides envisioned. But the truth of the matter is that the lack of trust that exists today, unfortunately, is nothing new. And in Talmudic times, it existed as well. And there was an institution called a chaver that was meant to defeat that. What is a chaver?
A friend.
A friend, that's the way we think of it. It comes from a term that's sometimes a verb, sometimes a noun, but the root of it is union, to join with others. A chabura is a group. If you remember the notebooks from Hebrew school or day school, they had on the front, it said? Machberet was usually what it said on the front, right? Because it's a bunch of pages that are joined together. Machberet. So a chaver is actually a member of a group. And it's often used that way in modern Hebrew. When they talk about someone being a member of an organization, they pay dmei chavra. That's membership dues. So a chaver is a member of a group. And going back to Talmudic times, you had a practice called the practice of becoming a chaver. And in order to become a chaver, you would go to a rabbinical court, and you would declare in front of them that you were going to be careful about the laws of tithing produce and the laws of purity and impurity. And everybody knew that if someone was a chaver, you could trust them. You knew that their produce was fine, you knew that you could eat, and you wouldn't have any questions. And that was their way of dealing with the problem of who can trust whom. They created an official status that people would embrace. The problem with that, of course, is you now create divisions. Because there were the people who went in front of a court and said, I will be a chaver. And then there were people who did not. And so the chaver won't be comfortable with the person who is not a chaver. At one point in the Jewish calendar, every year, or 3 points really, they would suspend the law of chaver. And the assumption once again was that everybody's food was considered to be pure and tithed. You would assume that it was fine unless you knew, unless you had reason to know otherwise. Everybody received the status of being a chaver, and those 3 times were the times of the Yom Tov, of the Regel, when all the Jews are supposed to come together to Jerusalem, Pesach, Shavuos, Sukkot. They would all have the status of chaver, and you could eat with anyone and assume that everything had been observed properly. Take a look, please, at source number 10. Rabbi Tzvi Hirsch Chayes, Maritz Chayes, writes, gives us an explanation for why the sages created this leniency. He says, the division caused is great when a person abstains from eating with another Jew. And the moment is especially bad when he is not credible regarding tithes and purity. The impact, really, is especially bad if there's no trust on those basic issues. It was not for naught that Rabbi Akiva said when he was in Am Haaretz, before Rabbi Akiva started to study, he used to say, who would give me a Torah scholar? I would bite him like a donkey. And it's actually harsher than that. This is Rabbi Akiva's quote of his own statement. He goes on to say in the original, he says, and not only like a donkey, but like a white donkey. Because in the Talmud they state that a white donkey's bite never heals. I prefer to avoid donkey bites altogether, white or otherwise. But Rabbi Akiva said, I would bite him like a donkey. And the idea behind it is because there was great animosity in his day between people who held themselves as scholars and were viewed as being self-righteous and apart, and everybody else. That's what he's pointing to. So this author here, Rabbi Tzvi Hirsch Chayes, writes, the essential reason for holiday pilgrimages was to join the hearts of Israel. That's why everybody would come together in Jerusalem, to create one nation. But that goal would not be achieved if they would not be mutually credible regarding purity. The sages insightfully eliminated the obstacle, lest the Satan come to dance among them, figure of speech, on these sacred days, causing enmity and division of hearts. They made all Israel as chaverim in the time of the festival. Everyone would have that status. And even amei haaretz, people of the earth, literally it means average people, are credible at that time for their wine and their oil. Because of this, chaver and am haaretz could eat bread together and join together in a meal of friends, and so increase love and join hearts to each other. they suspended the mistrust and said, at least now we all have to be together with a goal of having everybody join. Now, if you're going to, you might ask, well, then why not do that all year round? If it's good enough for three times a year, why not be able to do it all year long? And the answer may be that you also had an advantage at those times, which is people who came to Jerusalem planned to bring offerings in the temple. And therefore, they would specifically go to mikvah, and they would do this purification. So you had reason to trust that the person who didn't care about it all year long would be careful then. Right? Like somebody who says, you know, ordinarily I don't know, wear a yarmulke, but I'm going to walk into the synagogue, so I'm going to wear it. Right? So, or somebody maybe who doesn't observe things in general, but come Yom Kippur, they're going to fast and they're not going to wear leather shoes because it's Yom Kippur. That's a special day. So that you have that as your background coming into the holidays, and that makes it more doable from a legal perspective. But my point in quoting this is to show a practical application of that strong desire for peace, where they're willing to suspend very serious laws that are in place all year long and say, we want people to be able to get together. So that's the imperative for peace among us. But there are limits, as there are, because once we say that peace is not a pragmatic value of we want people to get together, but it's actually a religious value, it's part of our identity as Jews, there may be religious values that override it. Specifically, where unity comes at the expense of religion. Unity until now has been something that aided religion, that augmented religion, or enabled it. But what happens when unity would damage it? What would be a case in which unity would damage spirituality, damage religion?
During wars.
During wars? What do you mean?
Well, if the countryside was in disarray, if they were being killed, or I mean.
No, but where would unity damage religious growth? Take a look, please, at source number 11. A verse from Leviticus, Vayikra. Do not hate your brother in your heart. Instruct and do not bear sin for him. We've seen this verse on other occasions. Do not hate your brother in your heart. Meaning, if someone is doing something wrong, don't hate him inside. Instruct, or in Hebrew, Hocheach tochiach et amitecha. You should give him instructions. You should tell him what to do. And don't bear sin for him, implying that if you fail to instruct, in fact, you are going to be liable. This is telling us that the very Jewish practice of telling other people what to do is not our fault. It's a biblical imperative. It says, don't be angry at them in your heart. You should tell them to their face. There's actually a story, and I've never found out if it was true, but I believe it was. I believe this story to be 100% true. A summer camp that I went to, I don't know, 25, 30 years ago, there was a rabbi who was the camp rabbi, and he's actually a very big name, and you've probably heard of him, and so I won't mention him. But he ordinarily was the rabbi of a fairly large New York synagogue. But during the summer, he would come to the camp and he would, you know, teach the little kids, the campers, who had no interest whatsoever in any of that. And you know, we generally make his life miserable, as we did with all of the teachers. And this happened with a group that I wasn't in, but I heard about it from a good friend of mine who was there, and yes, I tend to believe he was telling the truth. Now, this particular rabbi got fed up one day, and they're all sitting in a circle. And he turns to them, and he recites this verse. Lo tisna et achicha bilvavecha. Do not hate your brother in your heart. I hate each and every one of you. He said, and they were like 10 years old. I assume he then went on to explain what he was doing. But yeah. Some people just aren't cut out for summer camp, you know. But that's what this verse says. The verse says you're supposed to instruct others. There's actually an imperative to instruct others. And this is where unity can potentially be damaging. Because if people are doing something that is wrong and we are afraid of telling them, because we don't want to damage unity, that's just going to lead people to continue wrongdoing. Moshe, and then.
Doesn't the Talmud say that our ability to rebuke is long gone?
Yes.
Even in the time of the Talmud, it was long gone.
So hold that thought, I will come to that. Moshe points out that there is a passage in the Talmud that says that from the days when a certain sage passed away, and you're talking about roughly 2,000 years ago, no one has the ability to rebuke anymore because we're all so sin-riddled that that no one has any credibility. I'm going to come back to that. Yes? Yeah. 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 So unity would be a good thing or a bad thing in that situation? You couldn't have unity. Right, no, there are times when unity will end up being sacrificed where people are on opposite sides of a conflict, whether the extreme case of the war, or even less so. That's certainly true. But in terms of this issue of instructing others and not bearing sin for them, it is a tricky thing to do. First of all, because the mitzvahs do it right. Right? Yelling at somebody in a way that is completely ineffective isn't a way to do the mitzvah. Right? In the same way that any mitzvah that we have in the Torah is, you have a certain goal, this is the way it should be done, don't do it in a different way. Rebuking somebody, instructing somebody in a way that they're not going to receive, isn't the mitzvah. So much so, there's a passage in the Talmud which actually says, just as there is a mitzvah for someone to say that which will be heard, so there is an obligation not to say something if it will not be heard. In other words, just because there's a mitzvah of tell people the right way doesn't mean that you should just say what's on your mind. You have to figure out a way that it will be accepted in order to do so. And along those lines, I come back to Moshe's point, which is a person has to have credibility in order to be able to do this. And it's certainly true, as the Talmud there observes, that we're short on that. It's also, from a contemporary standpoint, we live in a world in which judgmentalism is frowned upon. Right? The idea that I will see what somebody else is doing and say, this isn't right, may fit well biblically. But today, the answer is, you do your thing and I do my thing. Keep your nose out of my business. And so, it's a very unpopular type of a thing, trying to give somebody counsel. Nonetheless, within Judaism, we are all held responsible for the sins of the community. We talked about it already last week, but take a look at source number 12. Remarkable story revolving around a verse in Yehezkel, Ezekiel. Passage says, God never expressed a good verdict and then retracted it to cause harm. Other than in this case, there was one case. And this is the story. God said to him, he's speaking to an angel in this particular passage, pass through the city, through Jerusalem, and draw a tav, the letter tav, the last letter in the Hebrew alphabet, on the foreheads of the people, for all of the abominable acts performed there. And the Talmud explains what God was instructing Ezekiel. God's instructing the angel. The angel is Gabriel. God said to Gabriel, go inscribe a tav in ink on the heads of the righteous, so that the angels of destruction will not have any effect on them. Inscribe a tav in blood on the heads of the wicked, so that the angels of destruction will have an effect on them. Mark them as being different. The good are going to survive, and the bad won't. But then it continues. The trait of justice said before God, Master of the universe, what's the difference between these and those? And God responded, these are completely righteous, those are completely wicked. But justice responds, Master of the universe, they ought to have protested and they didn't do so. Those so-called righteous people didn't try to bring everybody along with them. God responded, I know clearly that had they protested, the people would not have accepted it from them. No one was going to listen to them. To which it responds, Master of the universe, if to you it is clear, to them is it clear? Human beings have no way to predict perfectly the actions of other human beings, and therefore they were responsible to speak up, and And as the verses continue in Ezekiel, God ends up punishing everybody starting from the righteous, indicating that, yes, they are held responsible for the actions of others. And so what I'm trying to show here is that unity can have its limits. If unity serves to promote bad behavior, if unity serves to promote bad ideals, then it becomes destructive. And there are many examples we could give to it, but because we have a whole other topic to get to, I'm going to cut to the chase. Back to our initial question, praying together, where it will have unity, but it's going to carry a spiritual cost. So what do you do? And the answer is, you need a dose of realism. So take a look at source number 14 and source number 15, two different authors writing on the issue centuries apart. The first one is source number 14, is the follow-up from source number 1. The rabbi who had been asked this question about the community where the Tunisians and the Copts and so on, they all wanted to split off from each other and make their own group, and they had done this in a very underhanded way. They had split off from the community. So he writes, one may not pray in a place which will distract him, or at a time when he will be distracted. Therefore, an individual or group who experience open or concealed enmity or anger or quarrel with the community will not be able to pray in an acceptable way. And they are not permitted to pray there, for their thoughts are distracted and they cannot focus in their prayers. This is certainly true if people overtly antagonize this person constantly. This is all the more true if the anger is with the leaders of the community. Were I not afraid to say it, I would say that it would be better to pray privately than to pray with a group of people with whom his mind is not at peace. There's also another reason, he says. One should not pray other than in a place where his heart desires, just as we say that one can learn Torah only where his heart desires. When a person looks at someone with whom he is at peace, his spirit is aroused into complete focus, and his mind expands, and his heart is joyous, and the Spirit of God then rests upon him. As we state regarding prophecy, this idea also that one needs to be in a particular frame of mind in order for prophecy to work. So his answer is, let them split. Even though we value peace among people so much, when it comes to prayer, you have to pray with people who you are at peace with. That's his ruling. Source number 15, Rabbi Moshe Sofer, also known as Chatam Sofer, Chasam Sofer, leading rabbi in Pressburg, end of the 18th century, beginning of the 19th century, also dealing with such a question, he says, woe to us that in our days such has happened. Gathering is good for the righteous and good for the world. But what can we do when our sins have created a situation in which we cannot gather them, and so they must separate? And so he acknowledges there does have to come a time when you split off. They're clearly uncomfortable. Neither Rabbi David Ibn Shalom, Ben Shalom Ibn Abi Zimra, Radbaz, nor Chatam Sofer, Rabbi Moshe Sofer, is happy about it. But ultimately they are realists, and they recognize that if peace is to be viewed as a religious value, then it may well be trumped at times by other religious values. Yes, Sandy.
Is this why we have two vads?
Why we have two vads? I think there are many reasons for that one. No, I think that's actually a different issue. Two different kosher certifying agencies was the question. Oh, you're talking about something else. You're not talking about that. I thought you were talking about that. Got it. So separate from the kashrut issue, you're asking about the fact that there is a board of rabbis and then there's a vad harabbanim. And the answer is yes. I think that is why. I think that fundamentally is why. It's a very difficult thing. I don't think you will find a happy resolution to the problem. And on that note, we move to our third topic.